Welcome to another episode of Cushman & Wakefield's Bottom Line Podcast, where we delve into minds of leaders, exploring their insights, philosophies, and the impact they have on the business world. Today, we are thrilled to host Anshu Kapoor, President and Head of Nuvama Asset Management. With an impressive career spanning 25 years, Anshu oversees asset management across private equity, listed equities, and real estate, managing an AUM of approximately $1 billion. As a key member of Nuvama's executive committee, Anshu drives several strategic initiatives for the group. Previously, he scaled Edelweiss's private wealth business 15x in just 7 years, positioning it amongst India's top three independent wealth managers. Let's welcome Anshu to the Bottom Line Podcast. It's a pleasure to have him at Cushman & Wakefield's office.
So Anshu, a series of unplanned events happened over the last sort of 1 year or so, right? So we were always looking at getting into a joint venture to create a platform, which we now have Nuvama Cushman & Wakefield's platform, and I'll talk about that a bit later. But as it happened, you know, we sort of, you know, chose you obviously because of your lovely name, the hairstyle, and apparently the suits that we almost share today, right? So it's like, are we brothers from another mother? I don't know. But I think the partnership's been great. But in this whole thing, I think while there are a lot of similarities between us, you're clearly the more handsome and the more energetic person. So I want to ask you, with this high stress that we all kind of live in, I've sort of always been struck by the energy, the positivity you kind of bring in on a daily basis, always smiling. What's the secret of that?
Thank you for all your kind words, Anshu. Well, my philosophy is simple. Don't defer your happiness.
Fantastic line. I'm going to steal that one.
Because as humans, think about people that we meet. Usually, all of us are planning to get happy if we get something. If I get that raise, if I get that promotion, I'm going to be happier. If I go for a vacation, I'm going to be happier. So my philosophy is, I learned from my kids, is just enjoy the moment. So don't defer your happiness. And I have my own anchors. So things that give me happiness or joy, which is spending time with family, spending time at the gym, and work. So that drives me and that keeps me positive.
I think that's excellent to hear. I think I'll definitely, as I said, I'll steal that line, because it's very hard for people to come out from a day-to-day kind of stresses that we all kind of live in. You graduated around the same time I graduated, which is sort of early 90s, right? And you know, the industry that we are in, real estate industry, the wealth management industry, was not really a thing back then. India had just sort of liberalized its kind of regime, and companies were coming in, big banks were just coming in. I think all of us have an interesting story as to why we landed up here. What's your story?
Well, if you ask me, Anshul, I mean, all of this is not planned. Did I know when we graduated or when I graduated that I would be doing wealth management or asset management? I don't think so. My father wanted me to become an engineer like himself. I had no aptitude for engineering. But the only thing I loved at that point of time was computers. So I would code all my time. And I was destined to become a software engineer. But then if you remember, early 90s, India was going through a stock market boom.
Yeah.
And I saw, you know, and I happened to watch all of that. And there were these images of people making a lot of money and, you know, stocks going up and all. So while I had accepted my seat in the university for computer application, at the last minute, I changed to finance, thinking this seems very exciting. This is something new. I must learn this. And from there, I pivoted. And you're absolutely right. In the initial days, we had no idea as to what India would become, what opportunities could come. So I think I am of the fortunate lot that just kept working hard and kept at it. And then one opportunity after the other came. And thankfully, it got me in the right place, which I am now passionate about.
Excellent. one of the things I noticed in your career is that you did have an overseas stint in Dubai, right? And I think that the big dream in 80s and 90s for people who were sort of, you know, growing up in that environment was to take the opportunity and go overseas. And you did that from the glitz and glamour of Dubai. What made you think about coming back to India?
Yeah, you're right. When in the initial days of the career, I and many of my friends, we were like frogs in the well, wanting to jump out. And because India was small, India was fairly close. It was small. Opportunities were less. Again, the path was not clear. So because I worked with multinationals, I got the opportunity to go overseas. But for me, the calling was to build something back home. And that is when I thought, let's go back and build something in India, because that time India offered for professionals at a very young age, you could build businesses, which otherwise you had to then spend 10, 15 years with a multinational to get to that point. That was my calling. However, when I came back, I was working with a multinational in India. I always had this onshore, offshore, global. So one leg outside, one leg in India. That way, I'm very fortunate, because at that point of time, that opportunity only existed in IT services.
Yeah.
Infosys of the world, Wipros of the world. In banking finance, very few people had that opportunity. So from that perspective, I was very fortunate.
Did you, for a second, imagine in 2008 when you came back that the industry would be as large and you would sort of, you know, I think Nuvama has what, roughly 40 billion or excess of $40 billion of assets under management 15 years later. Did your vision go that far back in 2008-09, thinking that, you know, you'd be sort of 40, $50 billion under management?
So I think the initial bets were, I'll tell you how we started the business and what was the philosophy behind starting this business. It was very simple. It was that what the customer gets today and what the customer should be getting, there was a huge gap. And all the so-called credible names, the foreign names, were exiting India at that point of time. After the global financial crisis, all of these guys were exiting.
So you saw the opportunity.
That left an opportunity. It was a simple starting point.
But it's a brave move.
Yeah, it was. And the second bet was that India entrepreneurship, the entrepreneurs of India will take off and create wealth similar to what has happened in the US. And that was one directional call, that bet on the entrepreneur. So don't bet on the old money, so to speak, bet on the new and the next gen money. And that bet we could not quantify today. I mean, this $45 billion that Nuvama has, we could not quantify, because I started in 2010. And by 2015, we were $1.5 billion. So it was very hard work. But then when we got everything right, we started to almost double every year. We got that great cycle just by being present, not doing something stupid. So to answer your question, no, I could not have predicted. It was just a directional bet at that point.
And what changed in the Indian investing psychology, right? Because Indians, you buy a house, invest more in real estate, gold, fixed deposits, insurance products, right? That's what we all kind of grew. So what really changed? Why this kind of move towards, what prompted the move towards the sort of more organized capital markets, mutual funds, sahi hai, or
absolutely. So I think it's a confluence of many, many factors. It's a confluence of, on one side, the regulatory environment in this country on capital markets is one of the best in the world. And it has taken some 10, 15 years.
That's quite a statement.
Absolutely. Yeah. Second, our adoption of technology. Everything is digitized.
Yeah.
I mean, banking, financial services, access is seamless, frictionless to investors. Therefore, information is available and abundant. And three, wealth creation happened in a very, very big way.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, for us, way back in 2010, 11, what you call, let's say, 1 crore was a very big number. And to get a 1 crore investment from a client was a very big number. But today, there are families or family offices who may give you $1 billion. So the scale of wealth creation also shifted. And the third factor was a lot of professionals also, through ESOPs and all, a lot of companies got listed. This ESOP created a lot of value for even professionals, which was earlier not available as an opportunity for the professionals. So all of this came together, and I think that drove this huge change. And one big trigger came as demonetization in 2018, if you remember.
Right. Yeah.
That pushed a lot of funds into the formalized part of the economy, GST, all of that. So formalization of economy started to go up.
And that accelerated.
Even the real estate, the RERA Act and all. So there is no one point, but there are multiple things as Indians, as democracy, as regulators and everyone else that we have done that has brought us to this point today.
Excellent. I'll just sort of pivot and talk about the joint venture that sort of we've created, which is a 50-50 joint venture to raise funds and invest in commercial real estate. So at Cushman & Wakefield, we are very excited about it, but would love to hear your perspective on why this asset class and why did you choose to go through a partnership route?
Right. See, from an asset class choice perspective, think about it. Real estate is the only asset class where 99.9% of Indians are interested.
Sure.
Right? Absolutely. This is a universal asset class in India. Maybe gold comes second. Equities and fixed income and all is still very far off. So there is universal acceptance. There is touch and feel. There is experience with the asset class. Maybe not so much with commercial, but with residential, definitely. So there is client interest. Clients have on their own tried in many, many forms, but have not been successful in making investments into this asset class. And on the other side, if you see, the asset class is exploding.
Yeah.
But who owns this? All the foreign funds, the sovereigns, the wealth funds and so on. So our thought process was, if there is genuine interest, genuine opportunity, what will it take for our clients to get a good solution? So for us, it was a question, not the question that there is demand or not, but of supply. I think that was one from a pure asset class perspective to answer your question.
Great, and we are very excited because we do think organization of this sector from an investment perspective is happening. And somewhere the retail access for institutional spending was not there. And I do think we can create a lot of value for our investor clients here. So, you know, I guess watch this space for
more. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Pivoting for a second, again, from here into perhaps more sort of, you know, your style of leadership and how you think about the organization. And one of the things that you often talk about is trust and credibility, which is very important in your business. I think it's very important in any business, but you speak a lot about trust and credibility because you're handling people's money. How do you, sort of, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it, and how do you actually, as a leadership team, instill that in your organization culture?
Yeah, I think a couple of points here. That's a very good question. Thank you for asking that. First is how you build the team. And in that, who are the key people? What do they represent? What values they bring to the table? It starts from there. And talent is in short supply. But within that also, you have to be really, really careful in bringing the right kind of talent. There, the simple framework is it doesn't matter where you've been. But what matters the most is where you want to be.
Yeah.
So give an opportunity to people to bring their dreams to work. And then create the right parameters of evaluation. If everything is evaluated only on revenue and PAT and PBT and all of that, that is what you'll get.
Yeah.
But if you are able to, in the mix, throw client satisfaction, performance, and so on, in the evaluation of our people, they will deliver differently. So from the very beginning, actually, if I can give you an anecdote, it came about. Way back when Uber came in 2011, 12 or something, I was in the US and I was taking Ubers everywhere. And every driver that I sat in the car, there were drivers who had done 5,000 trips, but the rating was 5. Hispanic guy, someone from Colombia. And I would chat with them as to what is it that they're doing.
5 on 5. Yeah.
Which means everyone has rated them 5.
Yes. And 5,000 trips.
5,000.
So big
so
a number.
So I wonder if not so educated guy can create this kind of service. You're a little mini entrepreneur Yeah. And that's how they get more rides and more incentives and so on. So if you change the model of evaluation, which is on customer satisfaction, mm-hmm. you get a very different outcome. Mm-hmm. So that got me thinking, and we came back, and actually a lot of our, what you call incentives or bonuses or rewards, got linked to customer satisfaction. That was one big change. The other thing we started to do, and we still do, sometimes in our sales meetings, we'll invite customers to come and sit. In our conferences and business plans, we'll invite customers to come and sit. Sometimes they come with their families. So that presence is a big statement for the entire team that we are working for the customer. The customer is one of us. And therefore, everything has to be aligned to customer. And finally, do not take things that are non-negotiable, not even once. So in our business, for example, regulatory compliance, doing the right thing, financial propriety is very, very important. You cannot have even one instance where you go into the gray and say, okay, let me do it once. Next time I'll see what happens. So you have to cut that, nip that in the bud. So these are some of our frameworks. And I think that's how we grew. That's because eventually customers feel that in your conduct.
Yeah.
Actually, customers will leave you, will pardon you for poor performance a little bit. They will not pardon you for poor conduct.
Poor conduct. I think that is very valuable.
And I think it's universal for all industries.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Good faith is really important.
Yeah.
Right? You need to look after your clients, your customers in the best faith. You know, performance, yes. Of course, everyone demands performance, but you can be forgiven.
Yeah,
but you can't be forgiven for bad conduct.
Yeah, and if I may add, our business, financial services, is about making people more confident of their future.
Yeah.
Let's say the numerator is their ambition, their desires, what they want to do with their money and their wealth, how do they want to get there. And the denominator is their worries, their issues, their concerns.
Yeah.
So if you are able to drive the numerator forward, take away the denominator, you're able to create value for the customer.
Yeah.
And that's how we think.
Excellent. And you also talked about talent. Lots of future talent is about Gen Zs, right? So what's your advice for them? I'd say two-pronged advice. One is working in wealth management industry, and second is investing.
Yeah. See, ours is the business of, like I said, deep relationships. And it is not something that you can just sell a product and come back. And that's the end of it. So like any other business, this is a business of relationships. And therefore, you need to instill that value in the Gen Z and the youngster, the interns who come, and then they become private bankers or join the sales team and all. So it's a long training curve, and there's a lot of shadowing involved in there. Talent is not there. We've built our talent as we gone along. Investing is a game of...
But still an exciting industry to work in.
Now it has become.
Probably still going to grow pretty rapidly.
So
it's great for careers.
Now it has become.
Yeah.
Earlier when we started, it was not a sought after field.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be consulting. At the top, and then financial services came right at the bottom. In between, there were foreign banks that came, and then everything else came right at the bottom. Slowly, as people have seen, the youngsters have seen the kind of growth. There's some glamour also attached to this. They are now more open to come and join this industry. But it's a industry that demands attention to detail, a lot of rigor, a lot of work ethic, a lot of knowledge build out, a lot of learning, and therefore a long-term commitment on the part of the person.
And their investment advice for the young guys who are joining the
industry? They are better than us.
That's great to hear.
Yeah, you and I could never have gone into Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But the youngsters...
That's speculative though.
But the youngsters went all out.
Right.
Actually, the youngsters have done something right. If you look at it, when I talk to very what you call sophisticated clients, and even the when I see the youngsters, they have a lot of risk-taking ability they have a lot more awareness and understanding that perhaps we had when we were their age. So there's a lot of learning we can have from them. And increasingly, we are seeing a lot of influx from technology world, you know, a lot of technology talent coming into the financial world and utilizing their skills in building investment models, which did not exist earlier. So I think those skills are very welcome in the industry, because this fusion of AI, technology, investing is happening as we speak.
Great. So coming towards the end of our discussion, just maybe a couple of personal questions. So if not this, then what would have been the story of Anshu Kapoor?
I would be in computers, behind a computer screen and coding right now.
Sounds rather boring from what you do. And it's not your personality, right? It's, I don't think it's your personality. Yeah. So I think you're in the right...
I keep telling my kids, if I get an opportunity, I'll go back to college, study AI, and come back and become an AI expert.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Excellent. I'm quite fascinated by technology.
Yeah. And as you kind of trace back 25 years of profession or your whole life, any person or book or any which kind of had significant sort of, you know, effect on you?
Yeah, great question. Yes. So from a professional point of view, my philosophy is never have a plan B.
Hmm.
It goes against what you study in
MBA. It's interesting,
Correct?
Yeah.
Never have a plan B. And how I learned it. There's a book called The Choice.
Hmm.
It's by a lady called Edith Eger. So the story, I'll just tell you briefly.
Sure.
She and her family are captured by the Nazis, sent to a Nazi camp in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Her parents are killed. She has this great instinct of survival. She makes the choice, I will live.
Okay.
In the end, she is found by the army and, you know, she's kind of brought out of the camp and all of that. She goes to become a clinical psychologist. She finds a way. She marries a royal family from Hungary, someone in the royal family. Her all her assets are again taken. She goes without any money to the US, trains herself, becomes a clinical psychologist at the age of 45 or something. And today she is one of the best clinical psychologists in the world, and she people with who go to war and all of that. But the main point of the book is that the world can take everything from you. The world cannot take what you put in your head.
Excellent.
So that is the point she makes. And it's very similar to if you read Man's Search for Meaning, again, you know, Viktor Frankl, again about the Nazi camp and all that. But this is the driving force that, okay, fine, I can become zero, but you can't take away my choice.
Yeah.
So that is the thing. Therefore, no plan B.
Excellent. That's, you know, again, very profound statement. And most people will go the other way, says, what's your plan B kind of stuff, right? But then if it is only plan A, you make it work.
Yes.
So you don't
have to find a way to make it work.
You have to find a way to make it work. Yeah. I'll end with asking you, what's your sort of passion project without beyond work life?
I only do three things at a time.
Yeah. Okay.
So first is family.
Yes.
Second is fitness.
Yes.
Third is work. I don't do the fourth thing.
Excellent. So, could I say fitness is a passion project? Or
fitness is always a passion project.
Yeah, because I've seen you. Yeah, so every time I met you, it's like you coming out from gym if it's in the morning.
Yeah.
So you work out 7 days a week?
Almost every day.
Yeah.
So if I eat, I move.
So Anshu, it was a fantastic chat. I really enjoyed our conversation here. I've taken there were lots of gold nuggets in there, but I've taken three nuggets away. One clearly was don't defer happiness. Second, what you mentioned towards the end was there's no plan B, which then forces you to work very hard and make plan A happen. And the third was customer centricity. You said customer may forgive you for not a fantastic performance, but will not forget you or forgive you for your conduct if your conduct was bad. So high ethical, good conduct, good corporate citizenship.
Thank you, Anshul. Thank you so much. Privilege being here with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.